Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Living in the here and now, and a lot of times when you hear people distinguish what is science and what is it good at, and you know, this is its realm, and there's a Stephen Gould's non-overlapping magisterium, you know, kind of model that science has its things that it's good at, religion or spiritual disciplines or whatever, they have their things that they're good at. And so in the here and now, lots of people say, well, science certainly isn't giving me the clues on how to live more richly, more abundantly, more satisfying life. I'm looking here at a William James quote that I like, but it's not God, but life, more life, a larger, richer, more satisfying life. This, in the last analysis, is the end of religion. The love of life at any and every level of development is the religious impulse. And so a lot of people will say something like, well, science is about the facts, religion adds meaning, or you know, draws sort of a sense of purpose or whatever that's essential to a happy, flourishing life. If I were to throw that at you, Matt, how do you feel in terms of separating those two, in the sense of not waiting, you know, until religion or until science can really do that? Or are you saying there's already resources within the materialistic stuff that science can sort of get at to kind of honor those sensibilities of I want moreness, richness, etc.?
Sure. There's a lot to say. In general, from a pragmatic viewpoint, I'm very, very okay with Gould's non-overlapping magisteria.
I just kind of mentioned I didn't really define it.
So Gould's non-overlapping magisteria wants to draw a pretty sharp divide between what science does and what religion does, and it wants to say that you know, science is involved mostly with the observable world, where empiricism can reign, and religion is therefore values and meaning making, etc., and that we should keep the two separate from each other, that we ought not to try and apply scientific methods to these things that religion is good at, and that we shouldn't try and use religion to make claims about what science is good at. The distinction that I want to make, which is between things that I find convincing and things that I think it's perfectly useful for people to believe. In general, I am loath to tell other people what they ought to believe, but I also want to sort of fight against beliefs that I think are harmful. And I think the non-overlapping magisteria, from a purely pragmatic standpoint, is pretty useful. I am, in general, people who have religious beliefs that differ from mine, I'd like as much as possible for them to feel like they can accept well-established science without running into conflict with their religious beliefs. And the non-overlapping magisteria allows that. From a more practical standpoint, though, I get a whiff, and this depends on exactly how you define the non-overlapping magisterium. Lots of people argue about exactly how this ought to be defined. But I catch a whiff of trying to protect beliefs from evidence. That is to say, I'm trying to avoid having to test my religious beliefs, even maybe some of those that do make claims that ought to be testable empirically, from the processes of science. And so in that sense, I get a little bit nervous about the idea, and I tend not to subscribe to it myself. Now, on the other hand, I think we've said this before, there are places where empiricism just hasn't gotten much reach. And so there are things like values, to an extent with ethics, although that's debatable, where empiricism isn't going to be much good. Do I think religion ought to be what fills the gap? Not necessarily, but something that calls itself spirituality isn't harmful to me. And I think that's why you get a lot of atheists who are open to, or rather embracing of, Eastern religions. You know, get a lot of people who get into Buddhism and meditation in that sense, because they don't necessarily oppose the idea of something that's not completely rational for helping them live in their day-to-day lives, but they want a religious or spiritual construct that doesn't insist that they believe in things that they think to be false.
Right. And that's where the fear of the God word and things like that start to really, you know, I'm going to stay away from possible God language, even though, you know, got Sally McFaig and other bunch of other people saying there's all these models of God that are not white bearded guy in the sky who's omnipotent and has all the omnis, etc. It's just too loaded a word, so they run from it. Yet they still want to nurture that other piece that sometimes God language at least suggests.
Atheists, especially in America, our religious, you know, landscape is one wherein there is a pretty dominant view of God, and that dominant view of God is something that is quite frankly hard to believe in.
Right.
So it's too hard to understand. They would shy away from the term entirely, even though one could parse out a much more workable definition.
Right, good. Steve, how do you respond to the basic, you know, since science hasn't gotten to where they can suggest values and, you know, at least in this rich, satisfying way, it doesn't really say what's the purpose of life. Therefore, it's important to let religion and its thousands of years of discussion and disciplined reflection upon things that are less observable in the laboratory, let them have their place to really jump forward and be a loud presence in our life.
Yeah, there's a great Simpsons where they discover an angel fossil, and there's nowhere for it to exist in Lisa's world, and the towns they divide sort of on the question of whether this angel fossil is an angel or something else, and Stephen Jay Gould actually appears in the episode and decides that it's inconclusive whether this is an angel or not, but Lisa gets accused of stealing it. I'll just cut it down to its core. So the judge is making a ruling after the fact that it's reappeared. But he says, it's my ruling that religion must stay 50 feet away from science until further notice, kind of thing, you know? Huh. And I think I'm not enamored with the non-overlapping magisteria. And in a funny way, because I really do think that science answers questions better in some realms. For example, on understanding the origin of life on Earth, understanding how Earth life developed, I think the physical brute facts of that are fascinating, and they are in science's realm. On the other hand, when I ask myself, what am I? And I ponder this experience I've had born at a certain time, and I think this is marvelous that this happened to me. I tend to not want to relegate religion to just being a source of ethics or good advice or platitudes to live by. And part of that is because for me, religion is a relationship with God, not a God isn't a rational deduction or a this is the way that Dennett and Dawkins tend to characterize religion, like it's just a bad deduction. You've got a set of facts, and you've come down on that there's evidence enough for a God in the world that you accept that existence, and that's just bad logic and bad inference, and you've made mistakes. And for me, and I only have my own experience. This is where first-person experience, I think, speaks to things that can't be spoken of objectively. You can't know the things that I've experienced. And for me, God has always been a relationship, and sometimes it's a troubled relationship, or it's a relationship that I don't understand in many ways. And yet it's always been there. And I recognize the scientific arguments, oh, you've got a God module there. But for me, this adds more depth than that explains it adds a richness that I don't think is captured by allowing me to define ethics. And it's very personal. It's not something that I can express in equations or words, and yet its reality to me is important. It's just a sense that there is more to me, my relationship, than science explains to me. And I'm humble about that in the sense that I recognize everybody doesn't have that same experience or that same relationship. But for me, religion has always been about seeking and trying to understand this relationship with God. It's not been about finding objective facts that support my view or giving me explanations for scientific findings like how life emerged on Earth or the kind of things you pull out of natural theology as evidences for God, because those are never compelling. I mean, I find that trying to use the evidence of the things in the universe that I see around me as evidence problematic. But I find within myself this sort of relationship that is important and I enjoy, and I derive from it ways to live my life and to find my way in the world that science doesn't explain and science doesn't really capture at all for me.
Yeah. So, Steve, all this, I'm loving what you're saying here, and I definitely want us at the end to really be able to say our personal choices. At this moment, can we stop for just a second, though, and let's get a little bit back more to defining religion. We did a good job at defining science, you know, in terms of its methodologies and things like that. And so I'd love to broaden. Are you guys open to broadening a little bit about what the religious approach or a spiritual disciplines might be?
I'm happy with that, yeah.
Okay, you guys talked, you know, there's this tendency, and again, I guess I'm listening to that segment of the Mormon Matters audience. I would say, you know, I get a sense that for most who listen, they're still alive to the spiritual life in some way. You know, definitely all the problematic ways that the term God plays out, or, you know, they've restructured beliefs so much, or their beliefs have bumped up against realities and it's challenged them. And yet a lot of them are still saying with you, Steve, there's this part of me that I just don't sense that science captures, and therefore I'm casting about for something new. But yet then there's the other group that just simply says, and there's kind of a dismissal of, you know, yeah, I tried it with this system or that, or I tried it with this term or that concept, and it was shown so lacking. I'm going to really go with stuff that I can count on, and the world of myth and, you know, metaphor and approaches that sort of are much more intuitive and things like that begin to take second stage. And so what I love to always try to do is sort of say, religion's rich. There's been thousands of years that there people from earlier ages and times and whatnot are not intellectually inferior to us today. They're working out of different models of the universe, different, you know, understandings of how things together, but, you know, they've sort of converged and they connect on certain pieces, and there's this thing called the perennial philosophy that is sort of says that, you know, for whatever day and age and concepts and things there are, there everybody's still sort of getting at this core something or other of the material world embedded in a wider world, and all these different things that, you know, we can talk about in terms of relationships or the different kind of the language that you guys were talking about. So here's religion, and it's been doing this thing, but it also, you know, they'll say, well, you can't show it in a lab, you can't, you know, you don't get the repeatability, and they forget that the fundamental core stuff actually probably does work that way. So for instance, let me try out the idea of, you know, what does science say? It says, if you want to know this, you go do this. Here's the experiments, here's the different things that I have done to do this and repeat it. Well, pretty much every religious tradition I've ever heard of, or every spiritual discipline, simply says, you know, the claim is, here's an experience. You want to experiment on it? Okay, do this. If you want to bake a cake, here's the ingredients you need. If you want to know if it's raining outside, go to the window and look. go for it, and here is the actions that I did, then do it yourself. And of course, it's not going to happen every single time the way you like it in science and things like that, but generally, these are called disciplines for a reasons. they do work. If you put yourself in this situation, generally this result was. And then the one thing that you guys talk about peer review and things like that come along in science, stuff like that. Religions have that too. They're also self-correcting. There's also these abilities to say, this experiment is different than that, experiment. Or when I approach the deeper stuff through this methodology, it seems like I get an answer that's different from when I approach it through that way. And so somehow or other, by putting those two things together, they've now widened the possibility of what that deeper world is and stuff like that. And then, like I say, with the peer review, you generally will have within a religious discipline those who are the elders, and they will basically, they can tell if you've had the experience or not. You won't answer it out of your head or out of a descriptive level. They will be able to tell and sort of judge that you have simply got it. So there is this feedback of disciple and guru and those who've lived, with the broader perspective longer. But again, I'm kind of blowing this and I'm talking too much. But what do you guys think in terms of these sorts of ways to kind of bolster the fact that spiritual disciplines are not just to easily be dismissed?
No, I agree with you. I mean, that's the scripture in Alma 32, the experiment upon my word, is a subjective experiment on trying to answer personal existential questions about God. Try it. See if it works. I mean, it is in a sense that experimental approach to religion, to pray, to see if those things that you value occur to you. And the difficulty, I think, is that because it's a subjective experience, I can't communicate it to anybody else in the same way that I can a scientific finding. I can hand you my data that I've written down in a book, and then you can go over it and analyze it the same way I do, and you can come to the same conclusion by the same hypotheses. And it's messier than that in faith. It's not as straightforward. I have a very good friend who has prayed his whole life, but he's never felt like he's gotten an answer. And so, there's a messiness in that that's real, but that messiness, I think, is part of existence. I mean, this conflicting is often this sort of conflicting experience where I can hand you my data and we can come to the same conclusion, compared to the advice to pray and seek and gain a testimony. And people who do that and don't have that same experience, it's used to dismiss religion in some ways. But I think that the messiness of subjectivity is vastly more complex. It's vastly, in fact, more interesting. And I think the questions of this messiness in life and in existence is part of the realities of being a human, being an existing person. And that is not a bug, but a feature. And yeah. I think that the variety of responses that people have had to spirituality, that variance has been marvelous in some ways. And so I'm not uncomfortable that religion can't be sort of put in the test tube, the same, you titrate it and you get the exact same thing. It's because my expectation of existence is much more complex.
Matt, I want to let you run with this, but Steve, there were a few things that you said there that I don't think you were quite. A lot of your things was I pray and didn't get an answer. I did this and somehow or other I didn't end up getting the testimony. All that feels a little bit too heady to me, too conceptual, too much of, you know, a couple of steps removed from what I think the strength of something like what I'm trying to suggest is, that if you do certain disciplines, simply like sitting with yourself, trying to observe your thought. I'm thinking here in meditation or something as an example. Some sort of discipline that within a few weeks, most people will say that when a thought appears to me and I say, oh, that's a thought, and I'll let that thought play out and stuff like that, there comes a fundamental shift within the person that says, you know, they will get it. At some point, I am not my thoughts. So there is an entity that's removed a bit deeper. And so there's this sort of a moving into an area that is far, you know, below what you were talking about with testimony or concepts or things like that. It's more that fundamental shift of a me that is deeper, something like that. And so somebody who's had a nirvana, you know, say if you're going through the Eastern ones or something like that, there is a sense about that person that they've sort of caught non-duality, or they've caught some sort of different kind of sense of an energy alignment of themselves as broader and deeper than you know, just this surface stuff that could be answered with your mind. That's the kind of stuff that I'm saying. It seems like these disciplines for thousands of years is saying this is what will happen if you do these practices. So Matt, you can jump in, or Steve, you can fight back.
Let me respond to this whole line of reasoning. So I am very open to the idea that religious institutions and religious practices, or substitute the word in spiritual if you don't like the word religious, perform a useful role, at least in many people's lives. You know, there are surveys that suggest that religious people are on the whole happier. You can find critiques in such studies if you want. There's also people like Alain de Botton who are arguing that even if you aren't a believer, there are things that religious institutions have done particularly well for the thriving of humanity that secular institutions, at least at present, aren't mimicking. Right. Now, that being said, I think we can ask the question as to whether or not existing religious institutions on the whole are really helping people out in those ways that you mentioned, Dan, or that someone like de Botton mentions. And it's my sense, at least, or my experience, that increasingly, at least in the West and particularly in the United States, that religious institutions are not doing a particularly good job of fulfilling people's spiritual needs. They tend more to be vehicles of a particular set of morals and values wrapped up in truth claims which ought to be taken literally in order for them to have force.
Right. And so because that's what everyone thinks, they dismiss the entire thing. And so help if you're recognizing that religions are failing at this area, would you also say, though, that the enterprise of whole of saying, is there soul, is there something that underlies my thoughts? You know, religion's failing. Mormonism is failing. Man, let's get it out there. We're screwing up. But occasionally, you know, there are pieces of things that we can actually take advantage of and go to these deeper places. But yeah, so I'm just trying to say, so many people want to dismiss it because of the exact critique that you're giving.
Right. So yeah, let me follow up to that to say, yes, I think in principle or conceptually, religion could, and I think for a lot of people still does, serve these purposes. But I think that for many of us, you have to work quite hard to winnow out those little useful nuggets amid all of the things that are not helpful and are in fact harmful.
Okay, but without something called spirituality or spiritual discipline, would you do the hard work and quote unquote get it? In terms of you and the
right.
Fact that there might be something below your, you know, all these things that are on the surface, would you do the work if without religions encouraging you, let's go Eugene England, without being forced to look in the face every week of people that you fundamentally disagree with, and you know, possibly at least it's happened for me enough times. All of a sudden, I can see that they're beautiful, and shift will happen, and those are precious experiences. Would you do the work without the frustration?
Right. In principle, I think something like a spiritual organization is probably helpful, at least for the majority of the people in something like that. Whether or not the current balance in religions of where the nuggets are and where the chaff is, the very harmful chaff. No, I don't think that most of that chaff is helpful. I think that it could be done probably much, much more effectively. Still sort of saying let's harness these sort of spiritual, for lack of a better term, lessons that have been learned over the course of humanity, but not packaged in such a way that there is as much strife associated with it. They could be doing a much, much better job than they are
totally,
right now.
Totally. I'm frustrated because there's, Matt, when you say things to fight over or all that stuff feels like it has zero to do to me with the religious enterprise, the spiritual disciplines, the you know, these brilliant practices that have developed that if you do this, you will have an experience. And it's that uniting experience, or not necessarily they're always going to be the same because there are different flavors when you approach from this and that, but somehow or other, it's so below the level of concepts and claims and things like that, that it's simply I now have a new relationship with reality. And the spiritual claim is, I feel broader, I feel richer, I know that I am deep, I know that I'm expansive, new energies come, and you know, all your little things that you start naming as, you know, concepts, already I just simply know those are partial at best.
So I think what you're saying is what you consider central to the religious experience is tangential to all of the problems of religion as it is practiced.
Okay. I won't say all, but yeah. Okay. But there's something there that when I'm talking about repeatability,
sure.
Being able to be peer reviewed, mm-hmm. sort of, but a direct apprehension. I mean, that's, you know, I've done the experiment myself. I now have a direct apprehension, and there's a fundamental shift that can happen,
yeah.
that I hate to see people dismiss because they get so hung up on the concepts.
Well, I think I don't want to get too exercised about this, but I think this is an issue worth getting exercised about. So let me actually revoke that. I think that if religious institutions spent most of their time worried about that, then I would say, hey, what's wrong with you people dismissing religion altogether? But instead, religious institutions, on the whole, at least in the Western world, spend most of their time doing things like reinforcing values or political causes that I consider quite damaging to the human condition. And as a result, it's hard for me not to be skeptical to religious enterprises in general. Now, I have my own personal spirituality that I go about, and I'm even conceptually open to the idea of a religious institution that would help me do that. But at least where I'm currently standing, what I see is religious institutions that are in general more interested in championing causes that I find morally repugnant than in helping me maintain some sort of thriving existence.
Okay.
And I think that while – so I think you're trying to say that those things aren't core, those things aren't central. And I think that ideally, yes, that would be so. But religion as she is practiced now in the United States – by not just in the United States, but in general by religious institutions, makes it very, very difficult and makes the cost rather high.
Yeah, and so, and again, what you've said there is a lot of what Brian Dalton was articulating last week and things like that. And so I guess for me, because we're in a science and religion thing, and we've talked about, you know, science has its realm, I'm just trying to carve out the best I can to say there are disciplines and practices and approaches in this spiritual world that yield really pretty repeatable results, pretty direct apprehensive results for those that will give them a try. And all the things that you were now saying about religion and moral reprehensible and they're concentrating on the wrong things, I'm absolutely in agreement with you. But if we're going to say, if in other words, so many people want to collapse everything in the spiritual realm into the science one and just let science overwhelm it. And I'm just saying, no, there's definitely things to be carved.
And I agree with that thesis. I just don't want to dismiss the practical problems
right.
of going about that.
Let me speak to that just a little bit. Because I hear that quite a bit. I mean, this is the point that Sam Harris always says, you know, religions are mostly bad. He draws on Islamic fundamentalism and Christian fundamentalism as right. examples of harms of religion. Let me give a different take on that. All of these institutions are human institutions. They're all subject to the sort of push and pull of what it means to be a human. And, you know, there's some nice evidence now that we evolved in a context of two dynamics at work, the dynamic of group cohesion and the dynamic of selfish interest. And that creates in humans a tension that exists in every institution. I mean, I did my sabbatical at the UN in Vienna, and oh my gosh, bureaucracy, the combination of harms and successes, the good that was done, the bad that are as easily identifiable in this very, very secular institution than any institution or religion on the planet. And I think what people sort of conflate sometimes is that any human institution, with all the messiness that a human is, with these conflicting group loyalties and loyalties to get ahead, are actually just the sort of natural problems of human institutions. It doesn't matter if it's the UN or a particular church, because there's conflicts between individuals, conflicts between groups. There's a tendency to circle the wagons, to promote loyalty and group cohesion. But I see that in secular institutions as well. And I'm coming to the conclusion that certainly those things are not good. Every institution wants to do well and do good, but the realities of on the ground holding an institution together trump much of the good that wants to be done. And Dan, when you complain that, you know, there's this spiritual core in religion, they all have, but that, you know, we can ignore the concepts that emerge from that.
Not ignore, but don't use the concepts as a reason to not actually see that there might be something underneath those concepts.
Oh, right. Okay, that sounds better. Because I think the concepts are actually important. A religion isn't just a good feeling. It has to be embedded into what you ultimately think those good feelings are coming from. I mean, if I could have
good feelings. I hate good feelings. Come on. Energies from something deep. That's where you got to be talking when you're talking religion. It's not feelings like the getting your sacrament meeting. Ooh, I have the emotion, so that's the spirit. See, I hate language like that that cheapens it.
Aren't emotions rich enough, Dan? I don't know.
No, I can tell the difference between emotion and a flow of something that, you know, where whatever the edge of my consciousness touches something broader, that is, you know, I just don't call that an emotion. I think it's important to distinguish that.
My point isn't about the language or the whatever sensual experience occurs during that. But my point is that in all of these things, there is something deep and rich there. I mean, these kinds of things can be interpreted in lots of ways. You know, they can be completely termed secularly. But for me, what it comes down to is, in fact, that internalization of that. You know, the structures that I've experienced that then become important to me. Maybe there's other structures and other people have different ones. But I don't want to dismiss religion because it's a human institution and it has the attending problems of being a human institution, because I can work on changing that, like I did in the UN. If there were conflicts and problems, there were areas where I could provide expertise to help overcome them. I can do that in my religion as well. There tends to be a tendency, like the podcast you mentioned, where all harms are pointed to religion. That's an easy claim, because religion plays such a huge part in human discourse, in human interactions. I mean, if you look at human universals, there's not that many things like language, music, but religion's one of them. It's deeply embedded in what it means to be a human. And it's really easy to conflate the harms of being a human into being the harms of institutions, which there are. I challenge anybody to find an institution that isn't limping along with, filled with conflict and problems and difficulties. Certainly some are more harmful than others. And I do like the idea of working towards less harm than more harm. But I hate conflating and dismissing religion as such because of those things, if that makes sense.
For sure.
I mostly agree with you, Steve. I think that it would be unfair or simplistic, whatever, to just say that religion is bad. Or I certainly don't believe anything like religion is doing more harm than any other, you know, collection of institutions. I don't think that those statements can be justified in the face of the evidence for a lot of the reasons that you point out. But the case that I want to make is that in an ideal world, maybe everybody would participate in some sort of a religious or spiritual institution, winnowing out the good and then doing what they can to oppose the bad as they see it. But what I want to validate is that the cost may be high, particularly for people who have been harmed by religious institutions, that have been personally harmed, which is a large class of people. And that when those people say, you know what, I'm done with religion and I'm going to take my business, my spiritual business elsewhere, that although it's possible that they might be able to do something else if they really, really tried and worked at it and made it a really super high priority in their lives, I don't blame them for not doing it. And I don't think that we should in general.
I agree with that. I mean, one thing I'm completely convinced of is that I can't extrapolate my experience to others. And I know people who have been harmed. I've had dear friends been completely devastated in certain ways. And for them, I would never blame them. I'm against the idea of assigning blame in whatever, you know, spiritual journey that people take. I do like it when they appreciate that mine has led me here and that I find value in it and allow that. It sounds like in the podcast last time was that my particular journey was being invalidated and dismissed as universally harmful. And so while I'll grant those people that have had bad experiences, their own faith journey, I didn't feel that that's being reciprocated. If they insist that my faith journey is of is suspect and you know, not allowed to be a rational or spiritual decision that I'm allowed, and I'm not hearing that from you, Matt, at all. I mean,
I
completely appreciate where you're coming from. And in fact, some of my best friends that I grew up with have made similar decisions. And what allows us to continue to dialogue is that we do value each other's viewpoint and understand each other's viewpoint and appreciate each other's viewpoint.
Well, let me quickly throw in, let's move out of this section. I'm also validating anybody's choice, and I'm never advocating that if something is harmful to you and it keeps, you know, you just don't stay there and continue to take the beating. I'm all for retreats out of bad situations. I'm all for things that will lead to greater health. What I don't want to ever do, though, is make it too easy for someone to say that because I've mostly experienced the harmful aspects, that there was never anything that was beautiful and good, and that if I really did dive into that, or I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but that there was nothing but but evil that animated this whole enterprise to begin with, that there wasn't spiritual intuition, that there wasn't sort of expansiveness and things that lead to universal harmony and peace or feelings and stuff flowing at the base of these religions to begin with. Even Kalili got all screwed up by the humans and everything like that. I just don't want to make it too easy to say bah humbug on the possibility that these kinds of energies that really do lead to flourishing in a different way than the kind of flourishing that you can have without religion. But I just don't want to make that too easy. Does that make a sense to you? I'm trying to validate, but also say, don't let your experience totalize the entire enterprise, because you would basically be ignoring so much good, beautiful wisdom. Boy.
I agree. Yeah, I think that was well put. And I think life is hard, and I think we are constantly beat up just by life itself, just existence. I mean, illness, sickness, accidents, relationships that don't work, that you know. But there are these beauties, and I think everything is complex and mixed. And I like the way you said that, you know, that too easily we look for a scapegoat for what are in reality the human condition. But not to undermine, there are harms that are done. I don't mean to imply that they're not, you know, that it's just a matter of perspective. I fully recognize that there are genuine harms, but I like that what you said, you know, look at it carefully and don't make it too easy to assign the blame.
Or dismiss the possibility of of energies that science will probably never really be an effective way to jump and try to access.
Yeah,
so
that's
me. Well, and one last thing. And when I talk about energies, I know it always sounds so new agey, and I'm getting called on it all the time. And so I guess what I'm just trying to, or here's the thing, if I truly am having these experiences, I naturally will fight against the evils, against the pain and things like that, the injustice. I will winnow out the wheat from the chaff, but it's always because I'm fed this core part of me that is beyond all the divisions sort of getting fed. It's interesting, my wife and I have taught the marriage and family class, and it's really, you know, in church, and you know, you go through it 5 or 6 times and you just really begin to notice the patterns of these lessons. They're almost like only about half of it is about tools for communication and understanding each other as a spouse, and the rest of it's like, are you living a spiritual life? Because guess what, a lot of the things that bug you, you know, just don't bug you as much when you sort of have this larger sense that might feed the vision of your spouse as a divine being rather than just this evil, you know, tyrant or whatever it is. This, you know, so it's like there's somehow or other there's that spending that time in this core experience that I can only say is better described through spiritual language or spiritual approaches, is better accessed through spiritual approaches. I just think that it's so important that we don't forget that you don't have to come up with all the willpower and muster it to fight evil yourself. You will just naturally do it when you're fed from that deeper sense. And so this is the whole section 121, without compulsory means, you know, things flow to you when you're sort of, you know, touching up or in an alignment with that, you know, you naturally won't let the beggar put up their petition in vain because you're centered in the right thing. You're getting fed by energies that would simply say, I will never cause harm to another. I will never dismiss them as an evil person because I know that there's beauty and truth. So anyway, that's kind of me. And I know you guys have like 9 or 10 minutes left on this call. So we didn't really do Mormonism, and it's basically, I think we've all agreed ahead of time, it's a very positive approach to science in general. There's that sense that even God is working according to natural laws. There's not really, in fact, maybe I'll have one of you guys back on if we ever do the mind-body problem, where we sort of sense that, you know, everything is material within Mormonism, and so there is no real Cartesian dualism of, you know, a non-extended thing or entity called the mind or the spirit you know, with extensive, you know, gross matter. So there's sort of this continuation. So Mormonism overall is pretty good. We certainly have the anti-intellectual, anti-scientistic sort of stuff that is, you know, has thrown up as rhetorical threads within Mormonism. But are you both pretty much affirming that if Mormonism is more naturalistic than most?
Definitely that. I think the way I would describe it is a lot of Mormon theology is very, very science compatible. And I think that it just bears the mark of being a religion that was founded after the scientific revolution. And so as a result, a lot of scientific ideas, this is how I see it, of course, as a non-believer, found their way into some of the core theologies. Now, I think on the other hand, there's a lot of anti-science difficulties that are sort of baked into maybe not so much our theology, but our parts of our canon. You know, I mean, it's not an accident that a large chunk of active Mormons nowadays don't believe in evolution, or that they may espouse some sort of young earth creationist views. Those things are there in our canon. You can parse your way around them if you're really dedicated to it, but you have to do the work to parse your way around it. So it's no accident that Mormons are more conservative than maybe even, say, mainstream Protestant Christians on a lot of these issues.
I know Stephen has to go earlier than you. Maybe I'll come back to you. I want to know what parts of the canon you're talking about. Because I definitely see it more as a social phenomenon, you know, when you get Darwin and things kind of coming up and upsetting the apple cart, and then we begin to have a rhetorical thread. But it's interesting. I'd like to see what you have in the canon. Steve, I know you're the one who really has the hard deadline, so I'll let you go ahead. Why don't you do this? Do whatever riffing you want to do on the Mormon science compatibility, incompatibility, and then if you don't mind just kind of closing with any of those thoughts that maybe I cut you off from early on about why you have the hope that you do, why you orient to both science and religion the way you do. And then, Matt, if you can stay a little bit on after Steve drops off, maybe you and I can go a few more minutes.
Sure.
Thanks. And thanks for doing this, too. And Matt, it's been great to get to talk to you, too. I feel like we need to hang out more. So
I agree.
Lunch on me next time you guys are all in the same state.
Yeah, I was going to say, I sent some good conversations ahead. Yeah, for me, Mormonism is theologically one of the most friendly to science that I can think of that I've studied. I mean, the idea that of natural law, embodied God, a material God, the idea of progression, all of these things lend themselves so well to scientific understanding. I honestly. You know, and I've written about this, I've written a few papers on this, that Mormons ought to embrace evolution with more enthusiasm than any other group. It fits so well into our theology and everything that we believe and teach. I think it's unfortunate. I think it's almost an unfortunate accident that the sort of anti-science feelings that you find without the church, because Matt's right. I mean, the last survey was, you know, 22% of Mormons believe in evolution. That's a sad statistic. And it shows an unawareness of actually the church's position on evolution. And the you know, this could be a whole podcast, but let me just say this. I see a trend where this anti-science crowd leaves the impression in a lot of people's minds, a lot of youth's minds, that science and religion are at odds, that the two are incompatible. And I think that's the most unfortunate inference that anybody can make. I don't compromise my scientific understanding of the material world at all with my religion. I love science. I embrace its findings, those things that change within it, or that I believe are established beyond reasonable doubt. I hold to fully. It doesn't affect my religion. And so science and religion to me are two explorations of a very deep and wonderful universe that I think are both absolutely necessary to understanding it in its fullness and in its complexity and in its richness, both in terms of understanding what how the world works, and also understanding how to live in this universe. I think the two are critical. So I guess the final word I would say, I would hope that listeners who are feeling that the two are in conflict and that a choice has to be made, that I think that's not true. I think that you can live a fully compatible life with both and then fully embrace both. I mean, I don't think you have to compromise your science to be religious or compromise your religion to be science, although for societal reasons, there does seem to be that sense. I've written in disagreement to that view, and I really hold to it that the two really are fully compatible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there it is. That's my take on it.
Well, Steve, thank you. And I just, you know, I'll always love the warmth and the excitement and, you know, the animation that when you talk about these things and it's clear that you're not just saying it, that you clearly this is you're fed by this in a way that's really delightful and attractive, at least to a guy like me and I think to our listeners. So thank you for being on.
Oh, thank you. And thank you, Matt. I again, we need to talk more.
Indeed. Yes, we'll do that.
So, Matt, two things then. I want to give you any of your closing thoughts to wrap it up and stuff, too. Do you want to quickly just maybe help me understand a little bit more when you say you see the anti-science stuff embedded in their scriptures? Maybe what you're actually seeing is you're just seeing language of God creating and just this overpowering, you know, interpretation of God that's in it. Or do you see actually roots of anti-science bias within it rather than just it's not dealing with it?
Not necessarily anti-science bias. So I think to maybe broaden this conversation a little bit, the question of whether or not science conflicts directly with religion can be parsed a lot of different ways. And the simplest way to parse it is, do the claims of a particular religion conflict with science as it's well established? And then, of course, the question turns on the particular claims of a religion. And so within Mormonism, what I see is, again, I agree with almost everything that Stephen said, that Mormon theology is actually pretty pro-science. I think that if the sum total of Mormonism were, say, the speeches of Joseph Smith in the Nauvoo era, and then you excluded everything else, you would have a religious tradition that would probably be rather progressive and relatively pro-science, depending on how the ensuing institution treated those speeches. But what I mean by that is there are things in the scriptural canon that conflict with science as we understand it now, at least if you read them in what I consider to be their most natural reading. You know, you have in Doctrine and Covenants 77, we have that the earth has a temporal existence of 7,000 years. That doesn't necessarily have that the earth is 7,000 years old, but most people parse it at least to mean that the fall of Adam and Eve happened 7,000 years ago. And so you've got humanity existing for only 7,000 years. That's completely contradicted by science. Now, I think your response is going to be, well, we can and read that non-literally. And I think, yeah, that's true. But in particular, the problem with Mormonism, or the difficulty with Mormonism, I should say, is that you have these things in the Bible, and we look to modern revelation as something that's going to corroborate or clarify the Bible. So somebody sees something, Doctrine and Covenants 77, they say, oh, okay, well, we are meant to take those years literally, because here in Doctrine and Covenants 77, it says the exact same thing. Here we don't have translation artifacts, at least of the nature that you get in biblical texts. And so it's not surprising that the average Mormon would conclude, in particular the average Mormon leaders, would conclude that the earth, at least in some sense, is 7,000 years old.
Yeah.
Of the patriarchs, you have some reinforcement of the idea that the flood was global in Ether 13. I'm not saying that these things aren't insurmountable, that there couldn't be other readings, but I think that because these things exist, it's not too hard to understand why Mormons who read the scriptures at face value, and especially in an institution that claims, hey, the purpose of these modern revelations is to clarify what exists in other parts of the canon. Right. It's not too hard to understand how they could come to these conclusions, and therefore they feel boxed into an anti-science view.
good. And then and the way I just would have to always handle that is to talk about the things that are far more expansive, and you get senses from other things that you don't have to read, like, for instance, the 7,000 years. And I'm trying to remember, isn't section 77 him, like, answering things about the Book of Revelation? I can't remember.
Yes, I believe that's right.
So I guess what the reason I'm a little hesitant to, so whoever listens to this know that I'm not saying this, sir. Part of me wants to say, well, he's looking at the Book of Revelation, which we know is the most symbolic and, you know, the thing that you take at the most mystical level or whatever you'd want to call it. And he's maybe either just clarifying what was meant by this beast or these horses, or I can't remember exactly what 77 right. covers with. And so you can kind of say, well, he's not really talking about reality. He's talking about the confusing parts of that text, which we know is sort of this apocalyptic vision, and there's part of me that, but I totally get what you're saying.
And I guess more precisely, I think that this is more of a problem for, or this is a greater difficulty for Mormonism than it is for, say, mainstream Christianity. It's funny because we have this whole, you know, we only believe the Bible as far as it's translated correctly, and so we ought to be very free to be non-literal with the text. But we don't grant, at least usually in the mainstream, we don't grant that same latitude, or at least not nearly as much of it, to the modern text. And so as a result, whereas a mainstream Christian could say, most of the Old Testament is metaphorical, and I therefore discount it in favor of what science tells me about those things, I think it is harder for a Mormon to do that. One can do so. But I don't think that it's surprising. I think that it's sort of baked in that we would have this strain within modern Mormonism.
Interesting. I love it. Good stuff to ponder. Matt, what would you want to close with in terms of science versus religion, science in dialogue with religion? You know, go ahead and reiterate any of the reasons for the choices that you make, and just kind of close however you'd like.
Well, I think the overarching question that we're asking is, does science conflict with religion? Of course, the answer is, depends on what kind of religion you're talking about. And I agree with Stephen in that science does not necessarily falsify all religious claims, but it falsifies a lot of them. And in fact, I would say it falsifies most of the religious claims that most people at least profess, regardless of what they actually believe and how they live their religion. They profess religions that entail truth claims that in fact have been falsified by science. The kinds of religions that remain after the dust settles are those kinds of religions that are what I'll call empirically minimal. That is, they make very few claims that could actually be measured. And so then you find yourself in a conundrum. I say, okay, well, do I believe in these religious claims that cannot be tested, or do I just dismiss them altogether, or do I hold to some sort of like really extreme skepticism where I refuse to choose, or just where I refuse to grant assent to anything that I can't believe in or that I can't test empirically? And so my response is to go ahead and do what you probably consider throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and to say all of these versions of God are not true. And I'll give my reasoning for that. I'll list in sort of increasing order of convincingness to me, and then I'll rebut my – because one thing that I admit is that one's choice – one's belief in metaphysical things is somewhat arbitrary. It's going to be based on based on premises that may not be that cannot be justified in and of themselves. So, three. One, Occam's razor. I know you don't like Occam's razor, and I think there are good reasons to admit that Occam's razor is a heuristic, and that it is very difficult to apply objectively because what one person considers simple may not be what somebody else considers simple. But when I see a bunch of religious claims that cannot be tested, and then the absence of religious claims, which cannot be tested, I think maybe we'll just dispense with the religious claims altogether. Two is a belief that these more nuanced claims that are more empirically minimal are what I'll call ad hoc. That is, it sounds to me especially growing up as a Mormon with a relatively mainstream view of the truth claims. Now I hear, after I've lost my faith in this view, that, oh, well, there's this other version of Mormonism that doesn't have these empirical problems. And it feels like someone has reverse engineered a version of religion that doesn't have these problems. And I think, ah, that feels ad hoc. That feels like you've constructed that exactly to protect your religious beliefs. And so my instinct is to say, that probably isn't the correct conclusion to come to. Now, what we would probably argue about there is what actually is the original version of the truth claims and what has been shifting over time. And I know people who hold to a more liberal view of Mormonism who claim that that is more reflective of the original version of it. And that would be a difficult question to answer. We sort of trudge through rather murky historical waters to answer that question. I guess I just had those two reasons. Yeah, I thought there was a third one, but now that I can't pull it out.
Do you want an argument against him, or I'll do a summary at the end where I'll talk a little bit about both those. So go ahead, keep going.
I feel like I have good reasons for deciding between these claims that I can't test for, and that I, as choosing atheism instead of religious belief, as is something that is based on somewhat arbitrary criteria, and I'll confess this, but it is still fairly well-founded, and that it is maybe a lot to ask to expect people, especially who have grown up in more mainstream faith traditions, particularly mainstream Mormonism, to then take seriously, take as a live hypothesis, if you want to go William James on me, to take as a live hypothesis these other instantiations of the religion.
Dude, I love it. I love your heart. I love your amazing brain, and you always give me things to challenge to me. So I'm going to give you a sense of my, you know, reasons for you know, being alive to, you know, at least the language and the approaches of what would be traditionally things coming in more out of the spiritual realm or the spiritual disciplines rather than the scientific discipline. So I'm going to do that, but quickly on Occam's razor. I don't hate Occam's razor. I hate misapplication of Occam's razor. So for instance, Brian, you know, Dalton last week was basically saying Occam's razor says that the simpler answer should, you know, should reign, and to him the simple answer is that Joseph Smith was raised in the 19th century. He had all these stories about Indians in there. There was sort of racism in the air, and so he basically wrote a text that, you know, embodied the racism that was around him, and that's the simplest explanation, and you don't need to even go and bother with the idea that it might have truly been historical peoples and whatnot. So that's fine. That's a simple thing, but, you know, the other half of Occam's razor is it has to handle all the data. You know, don't multiply possibilities needlessly, or I can't remember what the actual words from William of Ockham were or something. But, you know, but on the other hand, it has to be able to encapture the data. And so he was basically, you know, offering a thing that didn't handle complexity. And so therefore that was a problem. So I don't have a problem with Occam's razor in general. The same thing is when you talk about when something feels ad hoc to you, that, you know, the kinds of claims that are these empirically minimal ones, the ones that are all sent to save it, you know, you're saying something like it's there to protect beliefs and things like that. I can see that. And I know that there's lots of instances where things strike me that way too. I can just see the panic, or you can sort of sense, you know, that somebody is scrambling, and especially you get this in apologetics. That was another firebomb that Brian was kind of showing. Apologetics is simply, you know, it's the scramble, you know, and that's why religion is 500 years behind science and all the different things like that. It's because it's all in this panic mode to catch up. And I can see that, and so certainly I recognize those kinds of energies in certain things that you encounter. But on the other hand, boy, dive into the original texts of the different religions. Read religious people who aren't responding to crises brought on by religion, by science and things like that. And there again, I think you get a sense, at least for me, that there's some sort of energy flow that comes, and there's a recognition that this experience enlivens life. So I just tend to focus there, and I can recognize when spiritual texts and texts are focusing there rather than this ad hoc panicking, protecting beliefs kind of stuff. So those would be my two main answers there. And then again, you kind of talked about the things you can and can't test for. You know, we'll go back to the section where I was trying to argue you can test for them. I mean, it's pretty clear when you get into at least the disciplines of religion. You know, take me at my word, dive in, and we get them in Mormonism too. They're not certainly as well-honed as they would be in sort of a master-disciple kind of tradition like Buddhism or something where you'd maybe enter a monastery and you'd be under the tutelage of somebody and says, here's step one, and I can kind of, you know, judge your progress. And if you do this, you know, these will be the kinds of experiences that you will probably have, and I can tell when you've had them. So, I don't know, there's something to me that you can test for it there. You know, the invitations that, again, they're probably right. They're not the ones that are talked about on Sunday. They're not the religious level that most people are answering either. But those invitations within the scriptures, to me, have led me to a pretty good party. I've enjoyed, and my life, I feel, is richer because of animating energies that have come from regular deep dives into realms that, again, I never dismiss my mind, but I know that there's a big difference between being irrational and being non-rational. And I value the times when I have said rationality is not always king. There is certain ways of getting into it either. And again, this is where ritual comes in. This is where chanting or meditation or music or poetry or any of these other sort of meditations that are not primarily saying logic and story and concepts and coherence. When I play with those things, I have good experiences, my life feels richer. And so for those reasons, I will just always champion, never forgetting the good and the true and the powerful within religion, despite all the crap. And I can just say on Sundays, as I walk through my Mormon life, I have bad ones. I have fewer bad Sundays than I used to, because most of the time, if I feel like I'm centered where I've found to be the most powerful centering for me, the other stuff just, it doesn't feel, I don't know, it just doesn't bug me as much. and I'm able to sit there and look and say, there's light and there's truth and there's goodness around me, and I'm willing and I want to associate with these people, and they teach me things and whatnot. And so those are the kinds of things that to me come out of trying to live a spiritual life, an explicitly spiritual life. I know that you are having great experiences too, Matt. I know that you see good in people and all that stuff. So I'm just trying to say that this is why spiritual language helps me with that, and you're getting it in other ways too, I know. So please rebut I'll let you have the last word.
A point that I want to hone in on, because I don't necessarily disagree with a lot of what you're saying, which is the testability of the utility of spiritual practices. Now, I largely agree. I don't know if such a research program has been carried out, but at least in principle, one could easily say what kinds of spiritual practices lead to good effects, you know, with well-defined, with good definitions of what it means to have a good effect. I contend, however, that the recognition of those good things maybe doesn't have too much to do with whether or not we believe in a God, or whether or not we believe in ontological naturalism or anything like that, but more from a, you know, so purely utilitarian, pragmatic viewpoint. These are things that help people. And I think Buddhism is a good example, because I think this is why atheists are much, much more open to Buddhism and Eastern religion than they are to most Western religion, is because they tend to make claims about what makes one happy rather than true facts.
Right, right. Buddha never really explained anything metaphysical, right?
And so one could easily be an atheistic Buddhist, for example, and I know several. And so you say, look, we could test all these things. And I say, yeah, I agree. And once we have those things tested, they need not imply anything about any particular religious claim. Now, of course, this is drawing the distinction in a particular way, which you may not appreciate or may not agree with. But I don't. I guess what I'm saying is I don't think that one needs to necessarily. Let me say this exactly right. I don't think that one needs to believe in the supernatural or abandon naturalism in order to accept that religious or spiritual practices have measurable, testable good effects.
Right. And I never feel that I'm anywhere in the supernatural. To me, this is just energies that are embedded in the universe that are better accessed through these kinds of disciplines.
Right. And so to an extent, I hear you describing a religion that is compatible with atheism in a very real sense. If you define atheism,
sure,
broadly,
sure,
if you define
sure,
natural,
yeah. And if atheists wouldn't run from, you know, anything that isn't, you know, been discovered, you know, since the scientific revolution, you know, if there wasn't this, again, you're right. Absolutely. I would be fine with it. And, you know, one of the strengths about Mormonism that we didn't, you know, mention just because we didn't give it enough time is I love the fact that it both has an ultimate that's personal and impersonal. In other words, we'll talk about a personal God, but we'll talk about a personal God that's ultimately beholden to the structures of the universe, the uncreated nature of everything, I don't want to overclaim for science, but the idea that there's freedom at the very basic levels. This is a God that has to work with that and can't, you know, so there's the honoring of both the personal and the impersonal, which is great. So if atheists would just focus on the impersonal stuff and say that, you know, we can't get at that through our tools of science, then, man, we're on the same team.
I think that's about as much convergence as we could hope for.
And again, I'm thrilled, folks, for this. And I know that I think I worried that we over-jargoned it at the beginning. I think we kind of brought it back down more to earth and practical lived life, you know, here in the second half. So I'm glad for that. But please, listeners, come to the blog. Let's do it. If you've ever watched me engage people in the Mormon Matters blog, you see me kind of talking about this stuff all the time. So know that I'm, of course, willing to dive in again and to take your challenges and stuff. And Matt, if you can come, I know that you're so crazy busy the next few weeks. So folks, if Matt doesn't respond right away to your queries, give him a couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's almost likely the case.
Well, congratulations, good luck defending, and thanks for taking so much time with us at this really busy time.
When you mentioned that Stephen Peck was signed on, I was committed, and so. But this has been fun. I knew that we, you know, you and I don't see eye to eye, but we have such good conversations that I thought this is going to be a productive discussion. And then throw Stephen Peck in there, who's also, you know, imminently capable of a good, challenging discussion. I'm very happy with how this has turned out.
Me too. Thanks, my friend.
We'll see you later.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.